Up next, Out Loud with John O'Caldwell, part of the Gingrich 360 Network.
We all know that the black community votes overwhelmingly for Democrats, so much so that the Democratic Party takes the black vote for granted. Is it time for black folks to take charge of their voting habits? Today, one of the left's leading intellectuals and I debate the black community's relationship with the Democratic Party. This is Out Loud with Gianno Caldwell. Thank you, Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, for joining me today on Out Loud with Gianno Caldwell. A lot of folks know you as a very influential brother on the left. You're intellectual, clearly. You have your own show. And people may not realize that you, before you were on CNN and all those different places, you were on Fox News Channel doing weekly battle with Bill O'Reilly. And you did it.
Yes.
Yeah, Bill really respected you. I remember this one particular clip where he was giving an example about a coke dealer, and he said, "Hey, you look like one." And you said, "Well, you look like somebody who does coke." Those were the good old days where you could make jokes and people weren't as PC as they are now. So definitely a different place to be. So thank you for joining me again.
Oh, it's my pleasure, brother. It really is, man. I always love a good civil dialogue.
Absolutely. I've seen some recent chatter on social media, so that's what we're here for today. a good civil dialogue. So you are clearly a prominent voice on the left. You got a big platform. And I wanted to figure out from you, what do you think thus far of Joe Biden's presidency?
It's a good question. First, I'd say that the Biden presidency is exactly what I expected it to be. It is a presidency that won't meet the needs of the real left, but it will irritate the right significantly because he's not the centrist that he campaigned on either. And so what you end up with is a presidency that is slightly left of center, which is sort of what it promised to be, but I would argue not nearly as progressive as he promised, right? Which was to be the most progressive president since LBJ or since FDR, right? He ain't that. But he's also not the right winger that some people on the left were afraid he would be. But he's also not the socialist leader that many people on the right are now pretending that he is because of some of the spending that he's doing and because of some of the plans that he's trying to enact.
Well, I think a lot of folks in the middle, you know, most voters are in the middle. They're more so independent than anything else. They were told and sold on the fact that Joe Biden was going to be a moderate. And I know you said that clearly he's not. A lot of folks have said pre-election that progressives have said that they were going to drag him to the left, and we clearly see that happening. But what we're not really seeing is any policy specific and direct for African Americans, which is the reason why he's in office today, because of the black vote. Black folks seemingly, especially when it comes to Democratic politicians, seem to always get left out in the cold. They vote for him, they rally for him, but they never really get any tangibles for their support. Why is that?
You know, it's an interesting question, and I'm somebody who sits on the left, and I've been critical of the Democratic Party for many years for this. I wouldn't say we don't get anything for Democratic votes, but we certainly don't get the kind of race-targeted policy that other groups get. We are what political scientists refer to as a captured electorate. We ain't going nowhere. The assumption is black people going to vote Democrat no matter what happens. And so very little is done to get us to vote Democrat. What's done is to get us motivated to vote at all. So in other words, if 100 black people come out and vote, 92 or somewhere between 88 and 94 of them are going to vote Democrat. But if we don't speak to their needs, you're only going to get 100. If you speak to their needs or you promise them stuff, maybe 300 will come out. You'll still get the same percentage, but you'll have a lower turnout. So a big part of what Democrats' strategy has been is doing stuff to get voter turnout, but not trying to convince people to vote for them. And that's something that you don't see with Latino communities for lots of complex reasons, the biggest of which is just internal political and ideological diversity among the various types of Latinx voters. White folks certainly aren't trailed with an assumption that they're just going to vote for whoever. And so I think it's a big part of the fact, it's largely due rather to the fact that black folk don't have a lot of political options in a two-party system where they don't trust the Republican Party and where they don't feel like Republican policy speaks to their needs. And so they end up saying, well, look, I don't trust these Democrats. I don't like these Democrats. I like some of them, but at the end of the day, I know that they'll do better for me than Republicans. And that becomes the kind of end game. And so you don't see the kind of attempt to shift policy or shape policy around African-American needs and interests.
Well, you know what's interesting is I did see some various outreach from the Democrats, especially calling Republicans racist more so than they typically do, which we know that exists in every election. But because Donald Trump was doing a lot of outreach to African-Americans, especially African-American men, you saw what he got in 2016, which was 8% generally the black vote, 12% black men. And this year for African-American men who had a high school diploma or below that, they voted for him to the tune, I believe, 26%. So we do see when there is some policy tangibles, we talk about the First Step Act and a number of these things that I know folks on the left typically dismiss as real and tangible efforts. We do see black folks say, okay, I'm willing to give this a shot, give it a chance, but we, without any real tangibles, because I'm from the South Side of Chicago. I've heard the song and dance pretty much all my life. You know, white Democrats are racist, so we couldn't get anything done for you, but we're going to come back the next election cycle. We're going to have a fish fry, a chicken cookout, and we're going to tell you what we're going to do for you, and nothing gets done. Would you advocate for black folks just becoming independent versus being in that 94 percentile, which we saw under Barack Obama in 2008? 94% of black folks voted for Barack Obama.
You know, it's an interesting question you ask. First, let me get to the first part. I'm not convinced. I don't concede that black men, particularly educated black men, voted for Donald Trump because of policy tangibles. I'm not convinced that that's the case. I haven't. When I look at when I've interviewed folk and talked to folk, that's not what I get. Now, I don't assume that my experience is, I don't confuse my experience for data. So I'm not going to say that, you know, anecdotally, what I'm experiencing is necessarily the whole story. But if I look at Trump's proposed plans and I juxtapose that to, say, Ronald Reagan's plans or, say, Mitt Romney's plans, it's not that Trump offered vastly broader or even more targeted policies. And yet black men voted for Trump much more. I think that there were several things at play here. When we look at Trump versus Hillary Clinton, I think there's a very complex conversation we have to have about gender, about whether black men are willing to vote for a white woman and whether they're willing to vote for a Clinton in particular. Of whether they're male or female at this stage in history, given everything that happened with the Clintons in the 90s. The second piece of it, though, in the second election of Trump, the second election that he lost, is an interesting connection that many black male voters had to Donald Trump. And there's something about Donald Trump's personality, there's something about the way that he navigates the world that does sort of resonate with certain voters. And I'm not sure that it's because of, you know, Trump's vision of school choice or because of Trump's understanding of the free market. I don't think it's necessarily because, you know, any particular policy as much as it is who Trump represents, which I think is deeply problematic. But the second part of your question, I think is where we probably find some common ground. I don't believe that black voters should have allegiance to the Democratic Party. Now, I happen to be a Green Party member, and I've been a Green Party member almost all of my voting life. I voted for Joe Biden in this last election. It was the first time since I've been voting for presidents that I can remember that I voted for a Democrat in an election. And it was, for me, it was because of the particular stakes of this election. But I say that to say, I'm still able to weigh in on policy. I'm still able to be part of the conversation. I'm still able to drag Joe Biden in the direction that I want him to be dragged. But the Democratic Party doesn't take for granted that I'm going to vote for them. And I think that if black people had that kind of flexibility, it would be fine. But if all black folk are registered independent, but they still vote Democrat every single time, then you end up in the same boat. Democrats don't care whether you registered or not. I mean, it might matter for the primary, but in general, Democrats just want to know, are you going to vote for us? So if a whole bunch of independent black folks still voted for Democrat in every election, I'm not sure that changed anything. So black folk don't have to just change their affiliation. We have to actually change how we vote, not just in the national election, but particularly in these local and statewide elections.
Okay. Do you think folks are going to answer that call? And before you answer that question, because you were saying, hey, you don't know the reason why so many voted for Trump, if it's his personality, what the case may be. And many could argue that the personality was a part of it. Certainly people were attracted to his personality, his bravado, all of that alpha male type energy. So, yeah, I can understand that piece. But we also, if we're looking at the data, just in terms of how well black folks did over 4 years, by the time he was leaving, he was up for election, rather, during that time of the election cycle, unemployment in the black community was at its lowest on record. 5%, Hispanics, 3%. These are tangibles. You talk about the deregulation of the economy and how it benefited everyone. It wasn't just the wealthiest. Again, they would gain more because they pay the most in taxes, but certainly there was some tangible benefits, unlike what we're seeing with Joe Biden, who's regulating the economy, and he's coming out with a lot of kind of welfare initiatives, if you will, to say this is what I'm going to do for the black community, when the black community actually need jobs, not welfare programs.
But here's what I'm not following, though, because you're saying that the demographic of black male voters who voted the most for Trump were between earners of, would you say, 75 and 90,000?
I said the original number that I stated, 26% were those who had high school diplomas or below. Overall, in terms of black folks that supported him, black men, I believe it was almost 20%.
My understanding is, and I don't have the data in front of me, that's why I don't want to speak with certainty, but my understanding of the data was that the highest slice of black men who voted for Trump were actually those who had higher educational attainment and higher income.
Yeah, I don't have the data to support that particular conclusion. Yeah,
but because it's interesting to think about if the most vulnerable people are voting for Trump, or if it's people who honestly are fairly recession proof. For example, you know, when you look at black men who make over $75,000 a year, who have graduate degrees or college degrees, they're not recession proof per se, but they certainly are less vulnerable to the whims of the economy than, say, someone with a high school diploma and someone who's making minimum wage. And so I'm always fascinated to know which slices of our population, of our community, are finding resonance with Trump's message. But again, black voting patterns with regard to Republicans don't necessarily hinge on the economy. So you could look at moments under George W. Bush when the economy was fairly strong, right? Particularly the first 2 years of his presidency. And when he goes up for re-election in 2004, and John Kerry's on the table, it could have made complete sense to vote for George Bush based on the economy at that time. But they didn't, because there was something about George W. Bush that didn't resonate with them. And of course, we have 9/11, we have the Iraq War, we have weapons of mass destruction. There are other conversations going on. Similarly, you could look at the economy under the kind of small government, except for the military, Ronald Reagan years, and you see a very interesting voting pattern. Black men are not, they're voting for Reagan more than they did George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, and John McCain, etc. But they're still not voting at as high a number as they are for Trump, despite the fact that based on just the economic metrics, you could make a case for it. And so I think it's really complicated. I think that black people are committed to the Democratic Party as a cultural move, as a confidence move, and to a large extent as a for policy reasons. But I do think that Donald Trump might be an anomaly. And I wonder, and we'll know, and we'll certainly know in 3 years, right? When we put campaigning again, and Republicans are attempting to wrest control of the White House again, if Donald Trump runs again, we'll know, we'll have an answer. But assuming Donald Trump doesn't run, it will be interesting to see if anyone else in the GOP can get the kind of support that Donald Trump got. I think it's an anomaly. I think it's I don't see it happening again.
Well, there's one indicator that I think that you didn't reference there. And that's the fact that Donald Trump has been the only president, to my knowledge, or really in my lifetime, that has went after the black vote in such a way that it was almost his every conversation. When he was running in 2016, he would be before all white audiences and he would say, the Democratic Party have taken black people for granted. Republicans were afraid to use that kind of language, and they certainly were afraid to be looking to recruit African Americans to support them in the same way that Donald Trump did. You don't even see Democrats per se go after the black vote in the way that Donald Trump did. So if, for example, he doesn't run for a second go at it, really a third go at it, he and the next person, say if it's Ron DeSantis or someone else, they may not go after the black vote in the way that Donald Trump did. So then that would make him an anomaly.
That's fair.
So that's
I mean, that's a fair point. I think you're right. I think it would be so unwise, though, Gianno, like if after watching Donald Trump, despite all the drama, all the messiness of his presidency, secure that much of the black vote, it would be foolish for the Republican Party, whoever the next standard bearer is, to not follow Donald Trump's blueprint on at least targeting the black vote. And Donald Trump didn't just do it during the election. I mean, we're in the kind of moment of the what they call the doctrine of the permanent campaign, which is kind of post George W. Bush, where you're always campaigning. But Donald Trump was very particular to say, look, from day one until day whatever, I'm going to constantly be speaking to the black community. You know, whether it was bringing HBCU presidents into the White House, whether it was, you know, meeting at Trump Tower with everybody from Jim Brown to Steve Harvey to, I mean, this stuff matters. Now, I disagree with it as a tactic and as a strategy, as a philosophy, and as a policy move. Donald Trump and I just don't see the world the same way. So I don't agree with him. But if I were in charge of the GOP, or if I were managing the next presidential campaign for the Republicans, I would absolutely say, look, Donald Trump, just because Donald Trump did it don't mean it's wrong. You know, Donald Trump did a lot of stuff right tactically. And one of those things was targeting the black community in the way that he did. And so for me, you know, I think you're right that if the next person does what the GOP usually does, it wouldn't be an apples to apples comparison. I just have enough faith in politicians' ability to do what's best for them to think that now that they see that it works, that they'll do it. I mean, if you remember, I guess it's been over 10 years now. God, time moves so quickly. But after just getting smashed in an election, Bobby Jindal did the autopsy of the GOP. And he said, look at where we are. Look at what we're doing. Look at what we're not doing. And here's, you know, and they laid out the problems. One of them, of course, was the tent was getting smaller. The Republicans too often said, we're going to double down on what's already worked. Trump found a way to do both. He found a way, and you and I may not agree on this, but he found a way to appeal to the most racist sector in America at the same time that he said, I want some black people on board. I mean, it's actually quite stunning how he was able to kind of speak to a population that are so disparate and be so successful at getting one side and getting enough of the black vote to make him competitive in every state. That takes more than a notion.
You know, I disagree with you on that point, but we'll debate more after this quick break. Let's be clear. There were some people that were racist that they did like what he said. Okay, that's fair. That's fair. There were some people. But that's going to be the case with Joe Biden's base, too. There will be some racists that say, I like some of the things that Joe Biden says. That happens on both sides.
But if we're being honest, I think it would be safe to say that if you were to take the 1 million most racist people in America and line them up and ask them who they voted for, would you agree that Trump would win by a landslide?
I don't have I don't have any data to support that conclusion. But if we were to say a candidate who's using some language that may not be racially sensitive at times, well, both of them would be in that category, or a candidate who's literally legislated policy to put as many black men in jail as possible, who's used the N-word on the floor of Congress multiple times, whether it be he was repeating what someone said or not, I think most racists would say, hey, give me that person. You don't name Trump or Biden. They would say, give me that person, and that person would be Joe Biden.
Yeah, I think out of context, that could be true. But I guess I'm making a different argument. My argument here isn't about whether or not Trump is racist or whether Trump is even intended.
Well, yeah, no. And that's not what I'm arguing either. My point is.
No, I know.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that if you look, if you go to rallies, take MAGA off the table for a minute. If you look at the people who are marching in Charlottesville, right, as an example, I think it would be dishonest to suggest that those people who are marching to tear down, who are protesting the tearing down of Confederate statues, those people who are anti-Semitic, anti-Black, etc., are also voting, also voted for Hillary Clinton in the previous election. I think that would be an unreasonable interpretation. Now, whether Trump, I'm not, so when I say Trump is appealing to them, I'm not even making at this moment a judgment about whether or not he wants to or not. I'm not making a judgment about whether it's his fault or not. I'm not making a he's more or less racist than his opponent claim at all. I'm simply saying that Trump's campaign and Trump's presidency seem to appeal to those people. Those who made a choice for president, they chose Trump. And lots of other people chose Trump, too. I'm not saying that everybody who voted for Trump was racist. But I think if you're a racist, it's much more likely you voted for Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton in 2016. And then in 2020, I would make the same argument for Biden. But I have no, I do not believe that Joe Biden is racist. But I absolutely could dissect Joe Biden's career and point out numerous instances where he said some racist stuff or did some racist stuff or supported a racist policy. I would agree with you 1,000%. But just to be clear, you know, when we talk about the crime bill, for example, or three strikes or the Welfare Reform Act or the Prison Litigation Reform Act, all of these policies that emerged in the 90s, Democrats were in control, but Republicans supported them as well.
That's not
so
true.
For me, you don't think that Republicans supported the welfare reform?
Oh no, welfare reform in 96, sure. Yeah, but I don't understand where that would be institutional racism or racism generally. The 94 crime bill, you said holistically, you mentioned a bunch of policies and you said Democrats supported them, but Republicans supported them as well. Republicans as a whole did not support the 94 crime bill. There were some Republicans that voted for it, but the majority that voted for that was Democrats.
I'm going to pull up the roll call now, but
no, it's accurate. You can take my word as fact. The majority that voted for the institutional race, because my colleagues, a lot of them don't believe in institutional racism. I get it. I do. I think it exists in the 94 crime bill. Majority Democrats supported it.
I'm not disputing that, but I'm literally looking at the crime bill now. Everybody supported the crime bill.
That's not true.
It was 95 yeas and 4 nays and 1 he didn't vote.
You're looking at the Senate right now. Look at the House.
Yeah.
What exactly are you looking at? Because the majority of folks that voted for it, and what was the makeup in the Senate at that time too? That's another consideration. But the majority of the folks, especially when you look at the House of Representatives, were Democrats.
Right, but we're talking about the Senate where Joe Biden was, right? Joe Biden wasn't in the House; he was in the Senate. So, my point is, everybody voted for it. I'm not making a claim that Republicans were more for it. Maybe we're talking about two different things. You agree that in the Senate, nearly unanimous support for the crime bill. You agree with that, right?
No, I don't agree with that. I got to look at that record. I'm talking about the majority party stance. The majority party stance was Democrats supported it. It was their issue, their bill. Jesse Jackson went and sat down in the Judiciary Committee, and he said this was going to cause mass incarceration. And he was absolutely right. And he was the spokesperson for the Black community at that time, one in which Democrats supported. So with that,
wait, but hold on, I'm confused because this is just a matter of fact. I'm looking. There were 95 yeas, 4 nays, and 1 abstention. So again, in the Senate, we can't really disagree on this, right? I mean, this is a matter of fact, right? Almost everybody voted for it. Only 4 people out of 100 said no. That's a fact. You're still saying that most people didn't vote for it?
Look at the House. Look at the House totals.
I'm only talking about the Senate because I'm talking about Joe Biden.
Uh-huh.
I'm saying that Joe Biden supported it, right? I agree. Democrats supported it. Democrats advanced it. This was a project. In fact, this was one of the policies.
But you said Republicans and Democrats, everybody voted for it. That would mean if everyone voted for it, everyone in the House and everyone in the Senate would have to have supported it. That is inaccurate. It's factually inaccurate.
That's not what I'm saying. Let me be clear.
I'm saying, clearly
we're miscommunicating. So that we can be on the same page. I'm saying in the Senate,
mm-hmm.
where Joe Biden was, where Joe, because you're saying Joe Biden advanced, was sort of an architect in advance, a policy that had detrimental impacts on the black community. I agree. Most it was a Democratic project. I agree. I'm saying that Republicans also supported it, that this was not a...
And I conceded that point from the beginning. I said that there were some Republicans that did support it. That's what I said. And I said the majority that supported the bill were Democrats. That's what I said. We're on the same page.
No. Right. I'm saying, but the majority of Republicans who were in the Senate also voted for it. We agree with that too, right?
I was listening to your point in terms of the majority. I don't know what the Senate totals are. So if you say that that's the case, but that's still, we're talking about over 400 people in the House of Representatives. There's still more Democrats that supported it than Republicans. So that's the point there.
Sure.
You move on.
I'm not disagreeing with that.
Right. We were on the same page from the beginning. I said the majority supported it. Some Republicans did support it. Sure.
Yeah, but it wasn't just
majority of Democrats.
I have no dog in the Democrat. I'm fine saying the majority of Democrats supported it. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that's never been in dispute for me. My overall point in saying this is to say that I don't look at the crime bill or any of these other, and I wasn't just talking about the crime bill. Like I said, the Welfare Reform Act, Prison Litigation Reform Act. These are all bills that were that all. And I was speaking about all four of the bills at one time. That was the other thing. I wasn't speaking just of the House.
I know. And that's why I said bill. that's not true, because you lumped them all in there. There you go.
Right. And what I'm saying is, if we look at this body of work that emerged in the 90s, there were not Republicans saying, no, we should get softer on crime. There were not. In fact, most of the opposition, Republican opposition to these bills, were about the details of the bill, not against the premise of the bill. Right. As you know, in Congress, it's the devil's in the details. People say we don't want pork. We don't want these add ons. Democrats and Republicans tend to smuggle in other things on a bill that has nothing to do with the thing they're talking about.
Yeah.
We saw it with the COVID relief package, but there were not a string of Republicans saying no, we shouldn't have welfare reform. No, we shouldn't be tougher on prisoners.
What was wrong with welfare reform?
I'm not making a case about whether welfare reform was right or wrong. What I'm making the case.
You're just saying generally, when it comes to legislation and bills, is the devil's is in the details, and people put pork in it. Yes. Things that got it. All right, understood.
Absolutely. But also the Clinton presidency. Clinton was very strategic in saying, Clinton had a series of policies that he knew would be palatable to the mainstream, and he knew that would make him seem like a centrist. And Bill Clinton was quite savvy in this, and he understood that the crime bill, he understood that the string of bills that we just talked about would be things that would make him look reasonable and tough. And quite frankly, in many ways, it was the Clinton campaign and Clinton administration that threw black people under the bus. Because they said, well, if I can be a two-term president by governing this way, by attempting to govern from the center. Of course, they say now they regret it. It's very easy to regret things 20 years later, 30 years later. It's very easy to regret things when there's nothing at stake. The question is, how'd you feel when you were in the midst of doing it? And was it just an error of judgment, or was it that you did whatever you needed to do to succeed? And so when I look at that, I say, Joe Biden's a little bit of both. Joe Biden's you don't get to be a career politician. You don't get to be in the Senate for all that time and not have to make some calculations that are not ethically strong, right? But you can convince yourself that you're looking big picture. And then there's a way that I think Joe Biden has grown. I think there's a way that Joe Biden has been challenged and pushed and made to look at the world differently. And I appreciate that in him. And I think there are a lot of politicians like that. I don't think it's just Joe Biden. And so when I think about racism, and I think about what it means to live in a country where there's still lingering racism, and I think about who those people tend to vote for, they tend not to vote for people who speak about racial diversity. They tend not to vote for people who say Black Lives Matter. They tend not to vote for people who want to reform police. You know, all things that Joe Biden has talked about. Even though, again, I happen to think Joe Biden is not strong enough on these issues. I'm deeply critical of Joe Biden on these issues. But it's hard for me to imagine that someone who supports police votes for Joe Biden, if they're voting on that issue. Obviously, people aren't single issue voters all the time. It's hard for me to believe that somebody who cares about the environment, who doesn't believe in global warming, for example, or someone who wants to pull out of the Paris Accords, it's hard for me to believe they vote for Joe Biden. It's complicated, though, because, you know, voters vote for lots of reasons.
That's true. People vote for lots of reasons, and I think a lot of people, especially some prominent black folks, I'm not sure if you know Tariq Nasheed or not. He's been on a podcast. He believes, or rather he has said that he believes that Joe Biden is a suspected white supremacist, which he has a big following, as you know. And he says some very insightful things. He says some really insightful things on the podcast that made me think and say, man, I never thought about it that way. That's interesting. So when we talk about these policies.
Tariq Nasheed is very smart.
Yeah, very, very smart. Very, very smart.
Very smart, but a lot of insightful thoughts and comments on lots of issues.
Indeed, indeed.
Yeah.
Now, you were saying that, and I'm not trying to stay on the 94 crime bill because there's so much other things to be talking about than that, but you were saying that with Bill Clinton, it's interesting how you can say that you regret something 20 years ago. Well, Joe Biden is in office right now. It was his crime bill. We've not seen any policy push forward in terms of reversing some of the draconian effects of that crime bill. We saw with Donald Trump, he pulled out the First Step Act, which was what he said to be the first step in reversing these negative effects. What are you doing to push folks on Joe Biden's team on the left to tell him that he needs to right these wrongs that continue to devastate the black community to this day?
You know, for me, the strongest thing we can do is take to the streets and mobilize our votes. Those are two separate things, right? There's protest and there's voting. And for me, both of those things are key. You know, I've met publicly and behind the scenes with many lawmakers in the last few years to talk about these issues. I'm an abolitionist. I believe in the abolition of police and abolition of prisons. So Joe Biden and I will never be on the same page. But what I can do is make moves and support the types of reforms that aren't antithetical to the project of abolition. In other words, I don't believe in reform as the solution, but I don't oppose reforms that can create more livable lives as we fight to produce this new world, this ultimate world, which we might be decades from, we might be centuries from, who knows? But we have to fight and live in the world that we're in right now. And for me, that means, for example, pushing Joe Biden to say, hey, what about cash bail? Pushing Joe Biden to say, hey, what about privately funded prisons, federal prisons? These are things that we pushed him on during the campaign, and it's paid off because he's already saying no. No to privatized federal prisons. You know, Obama had already said a no to cash bail in federal prisons. That's something we're pushing on, pushing against the death penalty, pushing for retroactive parole and release for people who incarcerated for marijuana. In the 90s, who got these draconian sentences under these various laws. These are things that we can do right now. And these are things that I'm doing to push Joe Biden, but not just to push Joe Biden, but to push state level lawmakers, because so much of this stuff happens at the state level and we got to push them too.
Okay, so I'm hearing what you're saying, and there's two things that pop out. One, I get getting rid of the private prisons, but are you saying that are you against all prisons or just private prisons?
Yeah. I'm against prisons. I believe in the abolition of prisons. Yeah.
So what do you do with the people who, and I know I'm not sure how many children you have, but I know you have a daughter. So if someone tries to do anything to her, what do you do? You take the law into your own hands, or what is it you would advocate to prevent the destruction of life? What criminal penalty, is there any criminal penalties? Do they go in a corner for a few hours, or what are we doing?
Well, I think there's a lot of space between putting someone in a cage and sitting someone in a corner, right? There's lots of ways that we can reimagine the world. Yeah. No, I know. But I mean, these are the questions I get asked all the time, right? Is it a slap on the wrist? You know, do we give people a slap on the wrist, or do we, you know, and if, because people can only think in extremes, because that's how we've been taught to think, right? We've been only taught to think about the extremes, which are either we lock people in cages for years or decades or their whole life, or we kill them, or we do nothing. And the first thing I'd say to you, because it's an important question you're asking, the first thing I'd say is, well, I don't think about this purely in those extremes, right? The bulk of the cases, the bulk of the people sitting in prisons right now aren't there for violent crimes. The bulk of the people in prison aren't there as serial killers and rapists and murderers and et cetera, right? If they were, and there were 2.5 million of those, we might be having a different conversation. So I think about The various ways that the prison is used right now to cage people for crimes of need, for crimes of addiction, for crimes of mental illness, for crimes of homelessness, for crimes of poverty. And the first thing that we always talk about is investing in the world in such a way that those crimes are not necessary, that people aren't stealing to eat, that people aren't stealing to live, that people aren't selling drugs out of necessity, that people aren't using drugs to treat mental illness, and that we understand drug addiction as a mental medical problem rather than as a criminal problem. So part of what we have to do is strip away the logic of criminalization so that we don't always criminalize everything. I'm still getting to your crazy serial killer question. I'm just explaining because I think that's the right question. No, I think it's the right and fair question, because people aren't scared of the person who steals their TV in the same way they're scared of the person who might sexually assault them. So I'm with you. I don't want you to feel like I'm avoiding your question. I'm just saying, I think that we tend to only think in those narrow terms, right, of what happens to that small slice of people in prison for that. I think about, so it's about that. It's about imagining what the world would be like if we had decarceration. For me, prison abolition is about decarceration. It's about saying, how can we empty the prisons now? And during COVID, we saw lots of signals as to how that's possible. A whole bunch of people didn't do their time. We let them out. They were aging. They were dying. They were sick. They weren't a threat to society anymore. And we said, you know, we can let these people out. We did it for health reasons. But the truth is, we could have done it a year prior with the same consequence, right? They weren't more or less of a danger because of COVID. We let them out because they weren't really a threat to society anymore. So we have way more people caged than we need to. We cage people when they don't have enough money to pay for their bail. So essentially, you're in jail because you don't have enough money not to be in jail. That's an evil system. That essentially becomes a debtor's prison. So we can decarcerate that way. We can decarcerate by giving people suspended sentences, by doing work release, by doing community-based action, community-based dispute resolution, as opposed to adjudicating things in courts that lead to prison. We can empty out so much of the prison without separating fathers and mothers from their families, without breaking down communities, without stripping away so much of what we need. Excarceration is another part of what I'm talking about. It means that part of your question is, what do we do when people commit crimes? But remember, crimes are social constructs, right?
Okay.
I mean, they are, right? You would agree that everything.
I mean, there's laws that are passed, and people feel whatever is criminal behavior, they provide a punishment for it. Okay, got it.
So you agree that crime is a social construct?
They're created by people. They're created by lawmakers.
No, I'm saying. Right, but my question is, do you agree that crime is a social construct?
I agree.
You laughed at it, so I don't want your audience to
think
that.
No. Because I'm listening to where you're going with it. Let's continue. I want to hear your point.
The reason I'm saying that is because so much of our attachment to things, once somebody commits a crime, is that many of the things that we as a society agree on as crimes shift from time to time. For example, when I was growing up, if you told me somebody was smoking weed, oh my God. You know what I mean? Now it's like, oh, he's smoking weed. You know what I mean? People joke about it. People talk about it. You can run for president. I mean, even Bill Clinton inhaling, he had to lie about it, how much weed he smoked just to be president, right? And it was like, wink, wink. But like, now if you told me somebody was smoking weed, nobody would trip about it, right? So, but that was a crime. And so learning to read was a crime for black folk at one point, right? Black people and white people getting married was a crime at one point in history. So what I'm saying is, just because it's a crime doesn't necessarily mean that we have to punish it. We can reimagine what crime is and say, okay, is everything that we consider a crime actually something that we as a society want to commit to punishing? Now, some things I think at any juncture in history, we might say should be a crime. There are other things 100 years ago that should have been crimes that weren't. I mean, there was a time where you could beat slaves legally, right? That should have been a crime. Sexual assault, particularly among married people, did not exist. That should have been a crime. So I'm not, you know, lynching was actually illegal. They just didn't care. But so my point is, crime is people don't commit crimes, they commit acts. And then society decides whether these things are criminal or not. So another piece of this excarceration is making the determination about whether or not all the things that we call crimes need to be. And I'll give you a concrete example. Smoking crack, right? You grew up in Chicago. You had crackheads, as they called them, right? They called people crackheads. The crackhead was seen as somebody who was not just making a bad choice, but somebody who was a bad person. Juxtapose crackhead with the cokehead, right? You could have a cokehead lawyer. You could have a cokehead accountant. You could have a cokehead homie that goes to college with you, gets high, and then goes to class the next day. And we would say, yo, he's making a bad choice. But the crackhead was a bad person. So it was much easier to imagine taking someone addicted to crack and put them in jail because that's where bad people go than it is to take that rich guy sniffing coke in his office before he goes to a board meeting. Right. And that's around race. That's about class. It's about gender. It's about lots of stuff. And so my point is, we have to strip away some of these ideas we have about crime. You know, do we need to criminalize sex work? Do we need to criminalize two people on a corner shooting dice? Because there's plenty of people on the South Side of Chicago shooting dice. And you don't care about that when you walk past them. You don't really think they need to be in jail for illegal gambling, but it's still illegal. So we have to ask ourselves, are all these crimes on the books necessary? But then there's this thing that you're talking about, which I don't want to ignore. And for as an abolitionist, it's what I call, or not what I call, it's what abolitionists have called and what I echo, restraint of the few. Yes, there are people in society who need to be restrained from society. They do. I grew up with them kind of people. I grew up in the hood. It's people, you glad they somewhere else. I've seen people kill people. I've seen people do extraordinary harm to people. And it's not because they're poor. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's not. It's people who have means, who have resources. Sometimes people just do bad shit. And it is not my contention that we put them in a corner. It's not my contention that we give them a slap on the wrist. But the question is there a way to have restraint of the few in a way that actually makes those people whole again and makes the people they harmed whole again outside the logic of the prison? And you might say, well, why? Well, because the prison doesn't work. The prison doesn't actually rehabilitate. The prison actually produces more crime. The prison actually is criminogenic. It actually makes people worse than when you go to prison for one thing, you learn how to do more crime while you're in there. The prison is unsafe. The prison creates more untreated trauma. So for me, I'm not against developing a system of restraint of the few for the purpose of restorative justice. But the prison isn't the only model. But even if you say, all right, Mark, that's a distinction without a difference. Whatever you call it, you're putting people away for some time. Let's say that's true. I don't agree, but let's say that's true. That still would reduce the prison population from 2.3 million to maybe a few hundred thousand, which for me would be the ultimate way to undo the violence of the crime bill, the violence of the Prison Litigation Reform Act, the violence of the war on drugs. That's and I know that's a long answer, but that would be my analogy.
Yeah, it was so important to hear you out in your concept and your analysis fully. And I wanted to make sure that I didn't interrupt. But let me say, and I know that you're a very smart guy, but my opinion of this, and this has not been you just pushing it, there's been a lot of people pushing the same concept on the national level. I'll tell you, I think it's an intellectually bankrupt concept, and I'll tell you why. So you talked about coming from the South Side of Chicago. I talk about my best-selling book, Taken for Granted. My mom was one of those quote-unquote crackheads that you just referenced. I recognize that she isn't a bad person and wasn't a bad person then. However, there are people who are quote unquote crackheads that do criminal behavior and they abuse their family, they rob people, they steal from people, and they may murder someone just to get a hold of that drug, to get in their pocket. Those people deserve jail time. When you think about the fact that, I'm telling you, if you're gonna murder somebody, that deserves jail time. If someone shoots you, someone murders you, your family is gonna want to get justice, just like with George Floyd. His family wanted justice. America wanted justice.
Let me ask you just a clarifying question. Because remember, my premise was, if we invest in the world, because I agree, but most people who are doing crime as crack addicts are doing so as crimes of addiction. You'd agree with that, right? Like you said, they steal, they rob, they do this stuff. I mean, people, if somebody's stealing your VCR in the 90s, it's not because they just like to steal VCRs. They sell them to get crack.
Right, yeah. They would sell it. But still in all, there's someone being disenfranchised by that action. So that's what I'm saying. Let me finish this point real quick. This same philosophy that you're pushing is being pushed on the national stage. So I won't even say it's your philosophy. I'll say that it's being pushed on the national stage. There's people like Kim Fox. She's the Cook County prosecutor in Chicago right now, who's moving about life with this very same philosophy. She has, since she's been in office over the course of 3 years, has dropped all charges, and I'm talking about felony counts, real legitimate felony counts, which are up to murder, all charges for 29.9% of defendants. That's about 25,000 people. This has not made Chicago more safe. My little brother in a car, Memorial Day weekend 2017, in a car with two of his friends just sitting on the street talking. That's it. That's all they were doing. Two men walked up, shot the car 25 times. His best friend died in his arms. Should we reimagine the punishment for the shooters? Because it was two shooters at that point. Should we say like, oh, well, maybe they don't deserve jail time and we have to think about this differently? No, people want justice. My little brother wants justice. His best friend died in his arms and he could have been dead. I would want justice. So there has to be a place for the bad people to go, for those who refuse. And there's going to be people who refuse to obey the law. There's not going to ever be a time where we can just say, hey, you can be rehabilitated. Some people, simply put, cannot be rehabilitated. They have to face some harsh consequence in order to turn their selves around if they were to choose to do so. Would you not agree with that?
I would disagree with almost everything you said. I reject some of the premises, right? So again, you said that you're asking why shouldn't those people get justice? My premise, I'm not sure. I never argued that people shouldn't get justice. What we're disagreeing is on what justice looks like, right?
So Derek Chauvin, should he not go to jail? Derek Chauvin shouldn't go to jail in your argument. Is that right?
Yeah, that's my argument.
So you're saying Derek Chauvin should not be in jail for what he did to George Floyd?
I don't want to get into a soundbite thing. You understand that we're speaking about in the ultimate, you're talking about right now in this very moment, or are you talking about in an abolitionist world?
You're saying, you're arguing, generally speaking, that jails shouldn't exist. That's right. Or no?
Yeah.
Okay. Hold on.
You also remember me saying that we have to also have to navigate the world we're in, that it could take decades or even centuries to build the world that I'm talking about. You remember that part,
okay,
right?
Okay. So let's just say it takes decade. Let's just say one decade, 10 years.
I'm just saying, because it becomes a dishonest conversation.
You're the one that mentioned it. How's it dishonest? Are you being intellectually dishonest then? I don't know. I'm trying to understand your point. No, you're saying you don't believe in jails.
What I'm saying is it becomes misleading to the audience if because the way they walk with the headline saying Mark Lamont Hill says Derek Chauvin shouldn't be in jail, as opposed to saying Mark Lamont Hill is saying that we should construct a world that would deal with these issues in a different way. I also said that people who are a threat to society should be restrained and held out of society. I just think the model should look different than the prison as it's currently constructed. I also said that. And so to take all that away and just walk away with Mark Lamont Hill said Derek Chauvin shouldn't go to jail, I think that was a misrepresentation of what I'm saying.
Okay, so you clarified your point because you said, oh yes, that's what I'm saying. So you just clarified your point. Fine, we can move on from that.
I began by saying that again, this could take centuries to create. I also began by saying restraint of the few doesn't mean that people just go home. It doesn't mean that we give people slaps on the wrist, but that we reimagine how we can do it, but that the goal is restoration and rehabilitation rather than simply punishment. Also, I also never suggested that people shouldn't get justice. What I said is that justice may look different if we have other models outside of just the prison, right? I'm talking about restorative models. I'll give you an example. Someone shot the president, right? Ronald Reagan gets shot, right? This is a fact. He wasn't sent to prison. It's also a fact. You're not disputing any of this, right?
No.
Oh, okay. So it was determined that he had mental illness. And so for decades, he got treatment, he got care, he got medicine, he got coping strategies, he learned how to navigate society, and this man is now where? Back in society, reintegrated. But he didn't sit in a cage for 30 years. This is my point. So we could have a cheap headline of, you know, he says, you know, the person who shoots the president shouldn't go to jail. Yeah, but the more nuanced and sophisticated conversation, I think, is to say, what did that set of services do for him that still kept the public safe, that still held him accountable, but allowed him to re-enter society better than when he left? That's what I'm looking for. And remember, I also began by saying we have to invest in the systems that create the problems that we have. So again, if somebody is addicted to drugs and they're stealing because they don't have drugs, part of why they're stealing to get drugs is because they don't have access to them, right? Drugs are illegal. They're poorly regulated. They're unsafe for that reason. And you have to live in the underside of society to consume a lot of them, right? You can't just go and do heroin like sitting on the steps, right? And many people are unhoused. And so what would the world look like with safe injection facilities? What would the world look like with the decriminalization of these drugs? What would the world look like if we invested and created a social safety net so that the people who are the poorest among us still have resources for a living wage? At the same time that I would say, just to use the example with your beloved mother, I don't want her to stay there. I'm not saying that we should give her a living wage so that she can buy drugs. I'm saying give her a living wage at the same time that we're supplying drug counselors and drug treatment, and we're treating it like a medical problem rather than a criminal problem. That's all I'm saying. So I'm not saying ignore the fact that the person just stole your TV. I'm saying let's create a context where someone doesn't have to steal TVs to deal with a medical problem and a social problem. That's what I'm saying. So I'm not trying to ignore what happens when they steal the TV. I'm saying let's try to prevent the stealing of the TV through these other investments. But that doesn't change the fact that somebody's going to steal a TV, right? Everybody isn't going to follow this, the rules. There's going to be somebody who steals a TV either because they need to or because they just want to. Some people are just fucked up people and they just want to steal TVs. Let's accept that. I'm saying, though, if Gianno Caldwell steals my TV, I don't want you putting it here. I want you to make me whole again. I want you to restore me to where I was.
Restitution.
Right. Potentially, yes. And it could look like buying me another TV, but it could look like a few other things. And I'm saying that also has to be part of how we think about this. And if we do those processes, then the Derek Chauvins of the world or the Dylan Roofs of the world, right? These are awful people. They can be dealt with through mechanisms that we can create in society. There's no way you're going to tell me Dylan Roof is sane. There's no way you're going to tell me a child molester is sane. There's no way you're going to tell me a serial killer, the Boston bomber, is sane. I'm saying that they need mental health treatment as much as they need to be kept out of society. We can imagine alternatives to the prison. That doesn't mean that you don't get justice.
Okay. We're talking to Dr. Mark Lamont Hill. We'll be back in a second. Let me ask you about this, because you know, we're in a place where being woke is. I remember when woke was a thing, it was just kind of more among the black community, but now being woke is seemingly everybody's thing. And whatever the purpose of being woke was, has been usurped to something else altogether, in my view. So I want to ask you about wokeness and social justice. I recently saw a story about Coca-Cola urging its employees to be, quote, less white as a part of their company's diversity training program. Do you support that kind of thing in the workplace? At what point do we get too woke?
I still don't know what woke means. I'm still very confused about what people mean when they say woke. And I mean that's not me being silly or coy or like, I feel like it's a term, like you said, that has been co-opted so much that I don't know what it means to people. For me, woke, at least what Erica used to say it, you know, stay woke and all that. For me, it was about being socially conscious. Woke was about being aware. It was about being aware of who you are, as having knowledge itself. Now, woke to me is about playing into some real narrow, thin liberal politics that I don't necessarily share. And so, watching corporations or media outlets or whatever co-opt that language to look like they're part of the diversity, equity, and inclusion game, which is really about posturing and making themselves accessible to more money and resources. For me, I have very little trust or I put very little credence in those efforts.
Yeah. So would you agree that the Coca-Cola really advocating for his employees to be less white would be a form of racism?
That advocating for their employees to be less white?
Yeah. That's what Coca-Cola said. They said
I'm asking for clarity. You say do you want the employees to be less white? Do you mean demographically or to act less white?
No. To act less white.
I think that that's a very. The language is so ambiguous that I think it can potentially do harm. I can understand a context in which that would make sense, and I can understand a context in which that would be problematic. I don't think it's racist, but I think that it's wildly insensitive and deeply irresponsible unless it's given extraordinary context. And even in that context, I would say, is that really the best way to make that happen?
So if you and I were a part of a corporation, let's say Apple or whatever, and they came, no. Let's say we work for CPAC. If you will, let's say we work for CPAC and we were in a room with our white colleagues and they said, listen, you and Mark need to be less black. Would that be considered racist or would that just be deeply disturbing?
The premise of the question, the answer to your question is yes, it would be racist. And the reason why there's a difference is because black and white aren't opposite sides of the same coin. Surely, if you're from Chicago, you know all about the Black Panthers. When people stood up and said black power, surely you don't think that that's the same thing as somebody standing up and saying white power, right? Words have different meanings given the context and the histories that they come out of. Black and white aren't opposite sides of the same coin. One has normative power. One has state power behind it. And so again, I don't know the context in which Coca-Cola is saying it, but if I said, Gianno, what do you love about being black? I think that there are certain answers you would give, right? You could talk about all the shit you like about being black, right? If you walk up to a white person and say, yo, what do you love about being white? Right? That's a very different question. Not what do you love about being Irish or Russian or Polish or whatever, but what do you love about being white? And the reason why it would be an uncomfortable question to ask someone is because of what whiteness means in our social world and with the social and political meanings attached to whiteness. So it's not the same thing. And so when you ask me, well, what if a white person did that? Well, the context is different. You know what I mean? Similarly, I don't know if you're part of Blexit or not, but you know, if somebody says there's a Blexit, that's not the same thing as a Wexit. If white people say, you know, all the white people need to lead the Democratic Party, that shit would be profoundly different than saying all the black people need to leave. Why? Because there's a history and a context for why black people need to leave the party. The Democrats have served white liberals quite well. And white people aren't under assault or under attack in the Democratic Party, right? So a Wexit would be a very different kind of move. And so we could look at this across the board and say, well, yeah, that's why we don't have White History Month. That's why we don't have WET for a TV network, because these things aren't necessary in context. So when I hear them say, so part of what whiteness, part of what we've learned and part of what we talk about with regard to whiteness is when we say we're trying to rid ourselves of whiteness, typically what that means is white privilege. Typically what that means is being at the center of the cultural experience at all times, being at the center of the intellectual experience at all times. And so would I use the language be less white? No, I would not. But I wouldn't assume that that means the same thing as being less black. They don't mean the same thing.
Yeah, but that's your interpretation of it, as you would say. They said be act less white.
Yeah, you asked
me. They said act less. But here's the distinction too. You talk about how do you feel about being black? I can ask my friend Connor, for example. How does it feel being an Irish American, or how does it feel being an Italian American?
No.
You didn't say that. I'm saying. You said about the, you know, how does it feel about being black? That was your example.
I did not say that. That's what I said.
Okay.
No, I said, what do you like about it?
What do you like about being black?
That language is very specific.
Okay, what do you like?
The distinction is important. I'm not being pedantic. The distinction is important because liking something about being white when white is born out of a certain kind of power and privilege, it's hard to say what you like about being white. What it's like to be white is different. What you like about, ask a white person, what do you like about being white and see what kind of responses you get. What do you think a white person would say about, you have white white friends. I have white friends. What do you think a white person say? If you say, what do you like about being white? Not about your ethnicity, but about being white. What do you think they'd say?
Yeah, I've never had that discussion before, so I wouldn't know. I barely hear black folks saying, what do you like about being black? I don't really hear that. And I'm just saying, if we're talking about equality, if we want things to be the same for everybody, if we want it to be a even board, if you will, then one would say, if I'm going to tell you be less black, which we know, you and I both know that there's been corporations that have done this. There's been supervisors that said, listen, you should be less black. Therefore, you would be more appropriate for us. So you would be more accepted by us. If we're saying that that's racist and that's wrong, then saying be less white can also be viewed as racist and wrong. I get what you're saying. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, I disagree.
You're looking at it through the context of
context.
it's a different context. It's a different context, but that your context doesn't necessarily mean that it's right just because you have a different context. I can look at a glass that has water in it, and I can say that glass is half full or is half empty. That's context. That's the distinction. But either way, it's still a glass with water at a particular level.
Right, and I'm saying something different. I'm saying because those are objective measures. There's a certain amount of water in the glass, and my perspective may shape how I describe it, but there's still an objective amount of water in the glass. What I'm saying is that the very idea of white and black aren't objective in that way. They're not flat objective categories. They're categories and ideas and identities that emerge out of history, and they emerge out of politics, and they emerge out of social meaning. And so when we make social meanings about things, they don't necessarily mean the same thing. And so, and even an example you just gave, when I tell somebody, this is what I said, if you were to ask a bunch of black people, what do you like about being black? You don't think I think you can go on Twitter and find a hashtag, what I like about being black. You can find millions of people tell you all the shit they like about being black, right? You don't find white people in general talking about things they like about being white that aren't about, and if they do, it's from you'll see some very interesting answers. And I'd like you to do this, and anyone else listening, do this as an experiment. Ask white people, what do you like about being white? Not about being Irish or any other ethnicity, Italian or what have you. What do you like about being white? And the problem is it creates a discomfort because whiteness is often defined, or the things you like about being white are often in opposition to what black people don't have, or to what other people don't have. Because whiteness is about a power relationship, just like blackness is about a power relationship. And so that's why I'm saying it's different. And so when you ask, if somebody says to you, be less black, like you said, they're saying you need to hide things that society has decided are wrong and bad in order to achieve, right? Don't talk the way you talk. Don't move the way you move. Don't dress the way you move. Dress the way you dress. Don't do the things that you do culturally or don't identify in the world with a people that has been despised. Yeah, you're right. That would be racist. When they tell you don't be white, when they say don't act white, and again, I'm not saying it's okay. I'm just saying it doesn't necessarily have to be racist. Everything's not the same. If I say act less white, a lot of times they're saying, at least in experiences that I've had where this has been said, they're saying be more culturally sensitive. Listen to other people. Decenter yourself.
But couldn't you just say that? Don't take
it for granted.
Can you just say that?
I agree with you. I said there are other ways to do it. What I'm saying though is the sentiment behind be less white is not the same as the sentiment behind be less black. They're not the same thing. I agree with you that there are better ways to deliver it. I agree with you that this is not a helpful or healthy way to build community. We're on the same page that you shouldn't do it. But just because you shouldn't do it doesn't mean it's racist.
Okay. All right. I hear your point. Now, let me ask you about something because we're talking about wokeness right now and we're seeing. And to your point where you were saying, hey, you shouldn't be like this or like that. And you're using your example and your descriptor for black people be less black. I would argue that they're the same thing is occurring with white people, with a lot of white people saying, hey, I hate my white skin and I hate what has happened in this country and what me being white has done to this country. And that's a whole nother set of issues and probably self-hatred, because obviously these are people, ancestors, and not them actually committing the acts. But there was a guy by the name of Andrew Gutman who had his daughter in a private school in New York City. And he recently took her out and he wrote a letter to 600 parents about what they were teaching. And in the letter, and some of the things he said in the letter I disagree with, but I want to read this part. Here, what he said, I object to the idea that blacks are unable to succeed in this country without the aid from government or from whites. He disregards the view that blacks should be forever regarded as helpless victims and are incapable of success regardless of their skills, talents, or hard work. And he believed that's what they were teaching in the class. And I think to some degree, a lot of people can agree with that statement in terms of saying that, hey, you because you're black, you can't be as successful. And I grew up with people saying that to me, that I can only go so far in life because of the color of my skin. I'm talking about black folks telling me that exact same thing. And these are things that are passed down, theories that are passed down from generation to generation. I understand that there's systems against us. I understand the history of this country. I get all those things. But for us to form our mentality around we can't succeed because of the color of our skin is not just a dangerous concept. It's one that provides that we're incapable of any success whatsoever. So what do you do if you believe that you can't succeed doing things the right way? You get involved in criminality. You pretty much throw your life away. You don't believe in education because, hey, I'm not going to succeed regardless because of the color of my skin. Are you seeing that in this woke culture now? Are you familiar? You're not seeing that at all?
No.
Have you never heard of any of this?
No, what I've heard in my experience in the 42 years I've been on this planet is more black people acknowledging, because you're talking about black, this, you're talking about internal conversations. That,
yeah, yeah, black people, very black internal.
People. Yeah.
It happens, and white people are engaging in it as well. They're saying, hey, we need to bring about crutches because there's no way you can succeed because you're black. That does exist. We see that with very liberal whites.
Yeah, I'm just saying, you asked me about my experience. I'm saying, yes, no, I haven't experienced that. I'll give you an example. I went to Cook County Jail with Jesse Jackson one time, since you mentioned Jesse Jackson. You would agree that Jesse Jackson is someone who talks about systemic racism, right? And black people having a tough way to go. Jesse Jackson is not shy about criticizing racism and calling out racism, right? So we go to the jail, and he says to the incarcerated brothers, how many of you are here for a nonviolent drug offense? Hands go up, almost everybody, right? Systemic stuff. He says, how many of you finished high school? Almost no hands go up. He said, how many of you have kids? Hands go up. Two kids, hands go up. Three kids, whole bunch of hands go up. He stopped asking. He said, how many of you are here under 25 years old? Whole bunch of hands go up. So you talk about young black men, systemic drug crimes, kids, broken schools, the whole nine. But he's just asking questions. He says to him, how many of you want to get out of this prison or this jail? Excuse me. He said, how many of y'all want to get out of here? They raise their hand. He said, how many of y'all want to leave this place? He said, yeah. How many of y'all want to shut this prison down? Everybody raised their hand. They said, what do we do? You know what he said? He said, don't come back no more. He said, don't come back no more. Jesse Jackson has a critique of society. It's a critique of the drug war. It's a critique of broken schools. But when he met with those young men, what he said to them was, if you want to shut this thing down, don't come back no more. You from Chicago, I'll give you another example. Elijah Muhammad, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He said, we have to starve the system. Nobody would ever say the Nation of Islam doesn't have a critique of racism. But what he said was, we have to starve the system by cleaning ourselves up. So when you look at Marcus Garvey, when you look at Du Bois, when you look at Booker T, when you look at Malcolm, when you look at King, the argument in our tradition, the tradition I've been a part of, is not to ignore that we got work to do and that we need to do better and that we need some act right, but it's to balance the need for act right with the realities of a system in which we need to act right. And so when I hear people say the system is messed up, there's a conspiracy against us. They're trying to kill us. They're trying to arrest us. They're trying to push us out of school. They're trying to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The end game has never been to just concede to that. It's to understand, as Razkaz used to say back in the day, the nature of the threat. It's to understand what you're up against so that you can fight and win. So when I meet with young black men, I say, yes, there is a conspiracy against you. They want you gone. They want you erased. They want you silenced. They want you marginalized. But I said, the next question is, are you going to be part of the conspiracy or are you going to fight the conspiracy? And that's how I think about this work. And that's what I've always heard in our tradition. The system is fucked up, but you got to act right. And that's the only way we can succeed.
The system is effed up, but you got that right. Yeah. Wow. Let me ask you this question, because I really want to ask you about this. And, you know, it's about racism. Because you mentioned Jesse Jackson. You said, you know, he talks about racism all the time. Yeah, of course, racism exists. And I personally don't believe it. It will never not exist. I think hate will always be with us, whether it be hate against Hispanics, hate against whites, hate against blacks, whatever the case may be. I think hate is here to stay. I don't think that that's going to change at any point until Jesus comes. Maybe then, you know, that'll change. And I'm not sure how you feel about Jesus, so we'll move on that. But you see racism continuously being used in ways like, I saw that it was a transgender woman who says, for those who say that we shouldn't have biological men playing in women's sports, that's the new form of white supremacy and racism in this country. You have a home. I know you might be in your home right now. You have a master bedroom, right?
I do.
People are saying that master bedrooms, the phrasing of that is racist. People are saying that trees are racist. People are saying a lot of different things. And a lot of cases, what I'm seeing now, it has nothing to do with black folks and legitimate racism. White liberals have usurped what true and real racism is for their own agenda and their own benefit. And we got policymakers like Joe Biden, who no longer speaks to black people in terms of direct policy. He's saying minorities. Do you think that this liberals, like really far left liberals, or even just liberals in general right now, have usurped these, not even concepts, but what has happened with racism, and they created their own agenda to kind of fuel whatever they want to target and push forward in their own life?
No. I think that if we have a look at the grand sweep of history, there have always been these kinds of tensions and debates. There have always been these skepticisms of white liberals and criticisms of white liberals.
Yeah, Malcolm X was very skeptical of white liberals.
Yes, he should have been. And so I don't think this is some new movement as much as I see part of the tension of freedom fighting, part of the challenge of having moral and political clarity. What are we fighting for? What is the end game here? What is it supposed to look like? Is every fight worth fighting for? Now, you and I might disagree on whether these things are, these terms, these moments, these movements, these controversies, these stories are racist or not. I mean, that's almost not even the point, right? The question is, who gets to determine what the thing is? And I think too often we have surrendered our power to define and our power to lead our own freedom movement to other people, including white liberals. We've allowed too many people to shape the discourse or to tell us who we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to be. And for me, the best thing we can do at this juncture in history is to wrest that control back. And I think the most beautiful thing I saw in the streets of Missouri in 2014, or the streets of Minnesota in the streets of 2020, is the people taking control, the people seizing power, etc. We're calling for defunding because that's what we want. Damn what Joe Biden wants, right? We're going to call for Medicare for all. To hell what Joe Biden wants. And even though this isn't a particularly black issue, it should be. The Green New Deal, we're going to call for it because that's what we want. That's what the people want. And we're no longer going to say, or I pray, we're no longer going to say, not yet. We can't wait. The Democrats won't win on that. We're now saying, what do our people need? What do the people need? What does the world need? And we're making those judgments. And again, we may have disagreements. You and I may have disagreements. But if we love black people and we love freedom and we're willing to fight for it, then we can get somewhere.
Well, yeah, you're right. We do disagree, because I don't think black folks are so interested in a Green New Deal and some of these other things that you mentioned. But
I just said the exact same thing. I said I don't think that's
okay. Issue.
Said it should.
Yeah. But you said it should. But I don't think black folks are really for that. And I think Poland supports that. But I want to finish this conversation by talking about unity. It's no secret that our country is very divided. We often hear people, including President Biden, talk about the need for national unity. Is there any hope of that happening and what steps can be taken to unify the American people more than they are now?
I don't think you could have unity without justice.
Which include prisons?
I don't think prison is the issue right now. We're talking about unifying the people. I'm saying we're dying in the streets. We don't have access to capital. There's a huge wealth gap. Our neighborhoods are overpolluted. Our streets are being militarized. Jobs are leaving. I'm saying that there's too much of a gap between those who have and those who don't for us to be unified. There's also a big chunk of the country that's deeply racist, that's deeply homophobic, that's deeply transphobic. And the condition of peace, the precondition of peace has to be justice. So if people don't feel whole in whatever that looks like, then no, we won't have unity. We can't.
All right. So justice in the form of ensuring that police aren't unjustly killing people, justice in the form of black folks not killing each other, justice in the form of jobs coming back to the communities, which existed in pre-COVID. Things were going fairly well for a lot of people. So you're saying we need justice overall in order to unify the country in a real way?
I'm saying that, yes, but I'm going to be clear. The bar is very low right now. You know, where we were pre-COVID is not enough. Where we were.
Yeah, we were on the uptick. We were doing really well. Things, I mean, the lowest black unemployment rate in the history of this country, or at least since they've been recording the data.
But you're missing my point. I'm saying that the bar for justice and prosperity can't just be that. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that. This isn't a partisan argument I'm making. You know, whether we're talking about the Trump days, whether we're talking about the Obama days, I'm saying none of it was enough. We've never been close to justice. Are we closer than we were 50 years ago? Of course. I'm not making the case that there's no progress. What I'm saying is we still have so far to go. And the gaps we're experiencing don't hinge upon who's president. They hinge upon our capacity to imagine the world differently and better. And also our political will to make it happen. And we're so far from that. There's such a crisis of leadership, but there's also a crisis of imagination in this country, a political imagination, social imagination, cultural imagination. There's so much further we could go if we just dreamed differently and worked differently and organized differently and didn't just say, well, we can't do that because we've never done it before. And that's too often where we find ourselves.
Yes, I certainly agree with you that there's a crisis of leadership. We're seeing a border that's continuously in crisis. We're seeing a White House that seemingly, and they just got in, so I'll give them that. They've been in office for, 5 months now? So I'll give them the fact that they just got in, but they're seemingly a government that's not completely working for everyone. So that's a problem in and of itself. But before I let you go, what's next for you? Do you have any big projects? I know you want to plug your TV show.
You know,
you got a book out as well, I know.
I'm doing a lot. Very excited about it. You know, I'm the host of Black News Tonight, which airs every single day, Monday to Friday, 8 o'clock on Black News Channel, which is in 52 million cable homes. So it should be on whoever's listening's cable provider. If not, it's also on Roku Channel, Amazon, TiVo, all the things. I also am the host of Upfront with Al Jazeera. Our season just ended, but we'll be right back in the fall with weekly international news and just great hard hitting stories. I have the Coffee and Books podcast where I sit down with great authors to talk through their work, their ideas, etc. And I'm the owner of Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books. So if you're purchasing books or interested in, you know, critical, engaged conversations and beautiful, beloved community, go to UncleBobby's.com, UncleBobbies.com. And you can check out all the stuff, including our apparel. Our books, everything.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It was a great conversation. Thank you for joining me today on Out Loud with Gianno Caldwell.
It's my pleasure. God bless you, brother.